It's time for our tech and gadget phone-in here on Up All Night as we come just gone past 2:15. If you need help with a device, then Fevzy's going to be able to help you. Remember, he's the gadget.detective.com website if you want to go and have a look there. Assuming you can get your gadget to work, you can call 08085 909693. Text 85058 or email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. We're also at 5Live on social media. Fevzy, let me ask you a question. You know when you do the gadget of the week, generally, yeah, how many gadgets are coming out nowadays?
Oh, it's more than ever. And it's also, it depends also what you mean by gadget, because there's a plethora of apps for smartphones. I was struck by how many bits of hardware are being replaced by apps on our smartphones as well. So it's quite remarkable. I took a walk down Denmark Street, which in London, which used to be full of electronic synthesizer shops as well as guitars and things like that. And now it's very hard to find. And I thought, well, is everyone buying their synths and sort of music hardware? Are they buying it online? But actually, no, what they're doing is buying it in app forms. And I saw a synthesizer there. It was about £1,300 for a little hardware version. And then I realized I had the same synth on my iPhone which cost me less than £10.
That's true, though. I mean, apps are gadgets, aren't they, really?
They are, because they're software, but they completely change the nature of what you're doing. And in fact, our gadget of the week is an example of that, because it's a blood pressure monitor which has some special features. One of those special features is that it links via Bluetooth to your smartphone, be it Apple or Android based smartphone, and it allows you to keep a sort of a history and a graphical history of your blood pressure and whether you're suffering from any form of arrhythmia or anything like that. So it does that. My toothbrush is, I have to tell you, is now Bluetooth enabled.
How is it?
As well. And all manner of sort of health and fitness gadgets. So there's often a piece of hardware.
Tell me about your Bluetooth toothbrush. That sounds fascinating.
Well, it's a very similar thing. So it links via Bluetooth and keeps a record of when I brush my teeth,
okay,
how long I've brushed them for, if I've done it properly, did I press too hard, all of this.
How does it tell you if you've done it properly? Will it look at where you've been brushing your teeth, whether you've missed some teeth out?
No, it looks at duration, and it also looks at if you press too hard, because it's got a sensor for that. So and actually it gives you a bit of feedback, not the phone, but the toothbrush. So if you press too hard against the teeth, because it doesn't work. It's not like a manual brush where you can press hard and scrub harder. Actually, you have to keep it in contact, but not too hard, because the brush heads don't rotate in the right way if they're pressed too hard. So that sort of thing. But it depends, I guess, on what sort of person you are. I'm someone who actually benefits from visual feedback.
A lot of people would. And if I were to look at your visual feedback on your phone, what would it tell me about your brushing of your teeth? Are you doing well?
In the nicest possible way, I'm now burying my teeth.
Okay.
And I think we can all agree there's something to be proud of.
Yeah.
Well
done.
So thank you very much. But it's also the combination of all of this data, and it's quite remarkable. I mean, there are real benefits to be had by all of this, but also there are sort of privacy concerns as well, because very often, these are cloud-based services, a copy of your, heart and whatever goes up into the cloud. Often it's anonymized, but you could have an account in the cloud which could then be hacked. Would you necessarily want that? But I think that's largely the way it's going. And also, if you want the benefits of that, and you want, in this case, the health benefits of it, then sometimes we're faced with the choice of, do we share our data or in the cloud, not necessarily knowingly sharing it with others, although it's amazing. There's one device I saw which I can only allude to. But it's a device that deals with someone's prowess in the bedroom.
Oh.
And there's an option there to share that information with friends and family.
Oh, really? Family?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Well,
I didn't say it was always tasteful. I said it was interesting.
but I mean, that is part of the modern world, isn't it? That we have so many things that we can now link to our phones, and we seem to have a constant desire for data and information, don't we?
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting is the way that artificial intelligence or machine learning is starting to take effect in this. So it's not any longer the case that all this data is just, you know, simply you know, stored and regurgitated on demand, and you can see pretty graphs. Yes, you can do all that, but the machine intelligence starts to be able to understand the data and report it back to you. And there is, I mean, we'll deal with this as a gadget of the week in the future, but there's a gadget of the week, a gadget called Cardia, K-A-R-D-I-A, and it actually looks for types of arrhythmia like atrial fibrillation, and so things like that, which is, I think, the most common type of arrhythmia that a person can have. And the hardware is just a little plastic pad with two metal pads that you rest your fingers on, and it essentially does a two-wire ECG. And what's really interesting about it is not only is your heartbeat sort of sent up into the cloud, but they use machine learning to detect whether you are suffering from, in this case, atrial fibrillation or not. And the reason why they can do that is because all the people's heart scans go up, all their little mini ECGs go up into the cloud and are anonymized. What their technology can then do is then study thousands and tens of thousands and millions of these scans until it knows what to look for. And this is how machine learning works. This is why speech detection, voice detection circuits can now understand us without us having to train them. I don't know if you remember, but when you used to get sort of a voice dictation system for your PC or whatever, you'd have to spend the first 20 minutes training it in your particular voice and dialect and intonation. But now they understand you out of the box, just like we as human
sometimes,
beings.
Sometimes.
Well, largely and much more so than in the past, just like human beings can understand a variety of accents and dialects. So the machines can do that, and the reason why they can do that is because they have so many recordings of us to go by. So every time we fire up Siri, every time we speak to you know, Alexa or the Google equivalent, those devices don't usually recognize the voice in those devices. What they do is they send a recording of your voice that you've just spoken off to Amazon or Apple or whoever it is. They then crunch it, they recognize it, and then they send back a recording of an appropriate response. That's how these tend to work. They don't do the processing on the device anymore. And the benefit of that is, as I say, they get millions of examples, and that's how machine learning works. It used to be the case that when we were trying to teach, you know, robots to recognize things in the real world, like a cat, we would try to create a set of rules that would say this is what a cat looks like. And actually that's very difficult to do because there are many types and colors and shapes and sizes of cat, and every time the same cat moves it looks different, and you and I know how to say, oh, that's just a cat at a different angle. But to try and formulate rules for that proved almost
impossible. It's not easy, is it?
But if you give a computer or a robot access to tens of millions of photos that contain cats and tens of millions of photos that don't contain cats, and you tell it, you know, just simply that these pictures contain cats, these ones don't, the machine can start to work out.
So the more data we get, the better they'll get.
Yes, and then in the end they'll kill us all.
There we go. What a positive note there. At least you'll have clean teeth.
But for 10 minutes between them being useless and world domination, they're going to solve a lot of our problems for us.
Yeah, and you know, you'll have clean teeth when it happens. Let's go to Zaf now, who has called in. Of course, you can call in on 08085 909 693 and speak to the tech guru with the best teeth in the world. Zaf, what's your question?
Hello there. Hi, good morning, Rahul, and good morning, Sergi.
Morning, Zaf.
Morning.
Hello, hi. My question is that previously, the mobile phone that I had, I could use that to touch in and touch out on the London Underground.
Yes.
The problem I have with the newer phone that I've purchased is that this functionality is no longer there. So on investigation, it looks like although the phone I've now got is a more advanced one, my understanding is that it's missing the NFC chip.
Yes, near field communication. Yes, quite right.
Is there any workaround to that?
There's not. I mean, mobile phones are sealed units by and large. There's only one phone that's modular, and that didn't really succeed. So it's not really possible to add an NFC or a near field communication chip. So that's the same sort of technology, by the way, that's built into a contactless card. So no, I mean, the phone doesn't support it, you're stuck. It's not something you can add in software, and you need right. that. Having said that, of course, not only do things like Oyster cards in you know, London and some other cities work on near field communication, but now increasingly your payment cards, your debit and credit cards, also have NFC technology built into them and will work. So you don't necessarily have to have the equivalent of an Oyster card where, you know, you charge it up with money and then spend it. You can just use your payment card. One thing I would say to you, and we touched on this just in the discussion earlier, Zaf, is that there's always this balance to be had between convenience and privacy. So that's very convenient not to have to pay, you know, sort out your money or, you know, top up your card all the time. But so that's very convenient. But the downside of that, of course, is that when you pay either with your phone or a payment card, you are identified by that card, and therefore it's very easy to track an individual. So you know, there is that issue, because that data is stored and it's held private for as long as that organization is not hacked. And as soon as they're hacked, your whereabouts and your movements become a matter potentially of public record. So you know, this is something to be aware of. But as far as your phone is concerned, unfortunately, you do need that hardware chip in there for near field communication to work. And by the way, it's not only used, as probably you're aware, it's not only used for you know, touching in and out of on a transport system, but it's also used for things like you know, pairing with Bluetooth devices as well, where you can just tap it, or sometimes tapping another person's phone and transmitting automatically data between the two phones. So it's a nice thing to have. Apple phones didn't have it for a long time. The Android phones got it quicker, earlier in the development cycle, but still not all new phones have it, unfortunately.
Zaf, were you surprised when you probably thought you were upgrading your phone and you couldn't do something you used to be able to do before?
Yes, I was surprised. I think one of the reasons that the newer phone doesn't have the NFC chip is that I bought the Neo phone when I was overseas. I was actually out in India on holiday, and I bought a Neo phone out there. And although all the other functionality in this phone is more advanced than the previous one, I didn't actually go through the list of all the features that I should have in hindsight. And perhaps the reason is that out in India, they don't have a requirement of NFC.
I live in India, so and firstly, that's important, isn't it? Because I know that if you buy some phones and take them to other countries, some of the functions won't work, maybe 4G or some of the others.
Exactly. So the what's called the radio circuitry, which is deals with all the forms of wireless, be it cellular data or forms of Wi-Fi. That's one of the few bits of a phone. So you buy, say, an iPhone, that's one of the few bits that varies from country to country. Partly because of regulatory environments, but also, you know, priorities. Some countries don't use NFC to anywhere near the extent that we now do in the UK. And for example, there are much faster internet connections available in the USA on cellular than in most of Europe. And therefore, the chips that go in the phones tend to differ. I have to say, we sometimes get the short end of the stick in this country, even though you know, we tend to be reasonably advanced in some areas, but still our hardware doesn't always reflect it. So you do need to check, and it's difficult, Zaf. I mean, I don't blame you, frankly, because how many people would know to you know, compare the spec sheets of the European or non-UK model against the UK model? Most of us wouldn't do that, and even if we did, would we spot that detail? I guess from what you're saying and where you bought it, it's probably too late to return it for a refund.
Yes, that would be correct. So now, as you say, I do have the, I do use the contactless payment cards. It's just that in the past, it would be really convenient that even if I'd left the house and forgot my wallet at home, I could survive the whole day just with my phone.
Absolutely. And you know, I know of a number of people who do the same thing. And by the way, I mean, it depends what system you use. But for example, Apple Pay, and there is also Android Pay and Samsung Pay and so forth. But Apple Pay is arguably more secure than the card itself when it comes to contactless payments. And the, one of the reasons for that, well, there's two reasons. One of the reasons for that is that it only works when you put your finger or your thumbprint on the phone. So whereas with a card, if you drop a card and it's contactless, conceivably someone could pick it up and start making contactless purchases without any other form of verification. But if you lose your phone, obviously that's bad news, but at least they can't be spending money without your fingerprint in that way. So that's number one. The other way in which, and I'll take Apple Pay as an example of this, but the other way in which it works is with a normal transaction, when you provide your credit card or your debit card, quite a bit of information about you is provided to the vendor, because it needs to be in order for them to receive the payment from your card provider. With Apple Pay, what happens is effectively they get a token, they get a promissory token, which is as good as money. But what it means is that they don't get your full information. You know, they don't get all your card details and the three-digit security code on the back and all. They don't get that. And again, the reason why that's important is not because the vendor is not trustworthy, but because if they later get hacked, your information isn't sitting on their servers. So again, there can be benefits to this, and as you say, it's also nice if you leave your cards behind, or you can then deliberately leave your cards behind and be reasonably confident that you're going to be able to spend your way through a day or an evening using contactless, as long as you don't go above the contactless limit, which can be sort of £25, £30, £50 per transaction.
Bevsy, thank you very much for that. Zaf, thank you so much for your call.
You're listening to a BBC Five Live podcast.
If you like this, you might also like this.
Eye of the Storm with Emma Barnett.
Every day we're covering some sort of storm that changes people's lives forever. To find out more about our range of podcasts, click, tap or swipe bbc.co.uk/5live.
You, of course, are listening to the Tech Phone-In with Fevzi Turkup. Fevzi, did you brush your teeth while we had a few minutes break there? What was your Bluetooth feedback on it?
I didn't do anything like that. I was just listening intently.
How were you? Let's go to James in Belfast. James, you got a good memory because you want to ask Fevzi a question about something he said a couple of months ago.
Yes, it was about a wee radio, which Fevzi mentioned. And he actually bought two of them. I remember him saying that. And There was a rechargeable battery. I think it was like a battery that would have.
Yeah, I remember it. It was a tiny little thing that was about £20, wasn't it? And it was a radio with a built-in recording facility that could either record the radio onto a micro SD card, or it could record voice, so you could use it. And it was about the size of a deck of playing cards. And, so I think it was from a company called I think the brand was AGP Tech with a K, if memory serves me correctly. Let me just see if I can actually...
Yeah, I think it was, Fevzi, but what I wanted to ask you was...
Okay.
What was the battery life for them?
It was fine. The battery itself was a small replaceable lithium ion battery, which was actually one of the batteries that's used in a sort of small non-smart mobile phone.
An old Nokia.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah, and so you could actually replace it if it ever died, which is nice. But also, it meant that the way that you would power the device is you'd charge it like you would charge a mobile phone, using a micro USB connector. And even if you were out and about and didn't have access to the mains, those little USB charger batteries that you can take to top up your smartphone or tablet, you could actually keep it charged from one of those. But it was pretty good, if I recall. I mean, I think I would go most of the week before I need to recharge it. If you do a lot of recording, however, that would tend to deplete the battery more quickly.
James, are you thinking of getting one?
Yes, I was, yeah. And strangely enough, I was looking at them online and I was wondering what the battery life is like in them, because it's a strange radio to have FM, AM, and shortwave 1 and shortwave 2.
Yeah, but the one that I recall, so I just looked it up, it's an AGP Tech, so AGP-TEK, R08 was the model that we looked at, and that was an FM radio and an MP3 player, so you could also store on that micro SD card, which you know is something you need to buy separately, but there's, if you pardon the expression, there's cheap as chips. On that card you could also put quite a large music collection and listen to it either through headphones or through the built-in speaker. And it was also nice, I mean the display was nice, it was sort of this amber digital display, and it had a numeric keypad underneath it, which meant you could sort of punch up the frequencies of radio stations directly if you knew it and wanted to. My recollection is that it was FM only. I don't remember there being AM on it. I think it's FM. Yeah, not shortwave and not AM.
Is there much on shortwave nowadays?
There is, but it's not as commonly used because
globally the BBC World Service used to be on shortwave, but I think they've shut some of those down.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of stuff on shortwave, but it's kind of more for the enthusiasts these days because you can pick up international radio stations over the internet very, very easily and much cleaner sound.
Can I throw a normal idea? I have a wee Roberts radio, and it's just a wee basic one. It's a world band radio, and it had a wee card inside it, and it says BBC World Service, and it will give you these different type of frequencies and stuff like that. And it's an analog tuner on this thing.
James, are you still happy to use? Because a lot of people now would listen maybe through their computer or through their phones to radio stations using some of the apps that are out there. But do you still physically like having a radio?
Yeah, I like listening on AM.
Yeah.
For some other reason is I could listen to your show now on Radio Ulster, but I keep the radio under the pillow, and that would mean I would have to extend the FM aerial, which would probably get broke.
You don't want to have that under your pillow when you're sleeping.
You know, James, there are pillows that you can buy for your bed and for your head that have a speaker built into them where they plug into a device such as a smartphone or an MP3 player or a radio, and the idea behind them is that they feed sound to you through the pillow without waking a partner.
How much are those, Fevzy?
They're not expensive. I think they're less than £20.
Are they good?
Some are better than others.
I need a Father's Day present now. Yeah, you may have solved my problem here.
Some are a bit muffled, quite frankly. But, I mean, I think they do come into their own, as I say, when someone sleeps with a partner and that partner isn't so impressed by your choice of nighttime listening, and particularly people who maybe have insomnia as well and don't necessarily want to disturb others.
My wife gets so annoyed because I've grown up listening to the radio, and she gets very annoyed. Yeah, so maybe
people can't sleep unless they've got something going on in the background.
And by the sounds of it, James, you can't either. Do you like to go to sleep with the radio on?
Yes, I do, and I prefer it in AM. Yeah. I don't have to put the radio at a certain angle
I know where you're coming from, James. I mean, quite literally, one of my earliest memories, it's a bit sad to admit this, but was my grandfather, and he used to have this huge radio, which is a shortwave receiver, and he was a real, you know, enthusiast, and he used to pick up these really far-flung radio stations from all around the world, and you know, he had a very nice tuner, so you could just reject the stations that were right next to it, and literally one of my earliest memories was of him doing that and us listening to the radio together.
That's not sad, that's a wonderful story. And do you think that was where some of your interest in technology may have begun?
I think so, and also he was a professional photographer, and he was an early adopter. So when color film came out, he was the first there with color and with cine and all of this sort of stuff. You know, he used to adopt any technology as it came along. So I do think I sort of took after him to a large extent, and those experiences. Yeah,
I don't know what age you are, but I can tell you, about two streets away from me, there was a taxi double, and they used to use CB radios.
Yeah.
And I think they were chipped on channel 40, but it was just to keep people from bump pushing them and stuff, as it was known in those days.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I remember I had a CB radio for about 6 months, I think, and I eventually had to get rid of it because of the size of the antenna.
How big was it?
Well, the antenna was a sort of floor standing, so it stood about 5 feet tall, but it had poles coming out on it along the ground in a cross shape that extended about five feet in every direction.
Did you have to put it on their biscuit tin?
No, I had a pucker. I had a pucker antenna for it, but it didn't really work in student accommodation. I remember it was a Rotel receiver.
I used to have a Ferguson record player, and the local taxi depot used to come through the record player.
Yeah, we used to get quite a lot of bleed, and there was less regulation of frequencies in those days as well. So
a bit tighter nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah, much more.
What's that class as bleed over?
Yeah, well, and you can still get, you know, people still get receivers that pick up, you know, emergency frequencies and stuff. I think, I'm not a lawyer, but I think it's legal as long as you don't act on it. I'm not sure. But a lot of communications of that sort is digital encrypted these days as well, so it would be a lot harder for you to listen in to some of that stuff anyway.
James, thank you so much for your call there. You, of course, can get in touch with Fevzi on 08085 909 693. You can text 85058 or email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. We're also at 5Live on social media. We're coming up to 14 minutes to 3. Fevzi, a lot of text. Can we just run through some of these quickly?
Let's answer some questions.
Yeah.
Yes.
Steve in Hampshire. Any idea if the 10.5 or 12.9 iPads will be released in a 256 GB version, please?
They exist in a 512, a 128, and I think it's a 256 already, isn't there? So these are the ones that were announced just over a week ago, and they started turning up in Apple stores on Tuesday or Wednesday of this week. As you've said, these are the pro models. So there's a 10.5 inch and a 12.9, and they're unusual in that there's now a 512 gigabyte storage version. That's half a terabyte of data. I think they also come in 256. I think they both do. I'm going to check and just let you know. But 10.5 memory options.
Do you need that much? Because you are beginning to get, aren't you? You've got things that you can plug into iPads now to take some of the stuff off.
Yeah, it's a much neater solution to have it built in. Yeah, I mean, I've got some of these devices that do plug into the Lightning port on a modern device. And you can do it. I think what it reflects is the change in the way that some people are now using these devices. So, you know, we're using them for more grown-up things. I mean, for example, I use an iPad for studio use and for recording, and I've got
a lot of people do that. What sort of memory do you have on yours?
512. So, you know, the maximum, as soon as one became available, I ran out and bought it because it's useful to have the faster processing, the greater amount of built-in RAM. And I run things like digital audio workstations completely solid state, because in a studio environment, it's nice to have something that runs completely silently and is responsive and tends not to crash. One of the studios that I operate is completely solid state. There's nothing that moves in it except for me. And the diaphragm of my microphone, I suppose. For various uses. And we mentioned, by the way, earlier, synthesizers, you know, these software emulations of these classic old synths. And again, running one of, you know, running those and recording audio and processing and so forth, they tend to take up large amounts of data. Also, I'm a bit of
Do you find that people still buy less data than they, you know, less storage than they probably need sometimes? Because it's something you can't really expand with Apple, isn't it?
With Apple you can't. So with a lot of tablet manufacturers, they have a micro SD card slot in them and you're good to go. With Apple, they like you to buy a new one when it fills up. It's a bit like you buy a car, when the ashtrays fill up, you have to buy a new car. It's a bit of a shame in that respect. But you know, in that sense, if it's not upgradable, then you have to buy whatever you think you're going to need. I have to say, for most people, 512 gigabytes of data would be overkill. And to Apple's credit, they've doubled all the minimum memories of their various devices, because there was this silly situation where you had quite advanced phones and tablets that came with 16 gigabytes of data, and five of that would be taken by the system, so you were left with about 11 gigabytes, which, you know, was just you know, not enough for even for casual use, I'd suggest. But also, it depends what you do. If you take a lot of, you know, 4K video, that's going to chew up.
That's going to take a lot of data, isn't it?
And also, in my case, I buy a lot of Audible audiobooks, and I download them at the greatest quality, and I have a big library of them on each of my devices, and it's great to be able to have that. But they do tend to take up the space. But it's just nice to be able to have that. I've got a phone with 256 gigabytes built in. And I've filled in some few months, I've filled more than half of that already without trying.
We're going to go to a call in 1 second. Just one quick question I want to ask you. When you talked about downloading at higher, you know, in better quality.
Yes.
Would you recommend people do that? I mean, is it only worthwhile if you're going to connect it to a decent pair of speakers, or you have a good sound system around it? If you're just going to listen to it on your iPad, is it worth it?
Yeah, it's interesting. There was a step change when the iPod was announced so many years ago by Apple, because until then, people who used to buy sort of music devices used to buy hi-fis, and everything was about quality. It was, you know, the best speakers, the best, you know,
pickup. Oh, I remember endless discussions about
that.
Yeah,
the best amp, and where should you put the money? Should you put it in the source or the speakers or the amplifier, or should you try and spread the money evenly across the year? So people were obsessive about quality, and then along came Steve Jobs and said, iPod, you can fit your whole record collection into this, or your music collection. And then it went from being about quality to being about quantity, and the generation after generation, they had more memory, but they, you know, still now people listen to MP3 files, which in some cases are not really much better than cassette tapes in terms of quality. Some of them can be a lot better, but they're not necessarily the case. And in the beginning, the reason for that was, well, you know, bandwidth, the speed at which data could flow over the internet was very limited, and therefore, you know, if you had this really high quality file, it would take you a week to download it. But that hasn't been true for a long time, and there are some services where you can download what they call HD audio tracks, i.e. full quality audio. And it's one of the things that still bugs me now, is that if you want to buy music as a download, and we'll forget about streams for now because that tends to be even worse, but just downloads, you can't buy, in most cases you can't buy an album or a track at the same quality as a CD that's been around since the 1980s. You have to get lower quality. And in fact, what I end up doing is buying the CD and ripping it. That's to say,
that you can put into that.
Yeah, that's by the way, is now legal.
Yeah,
for your own use.
That's a good idea. Let's go to Pete in Leeds. Pete, thank you so much for calling in. And what would you like to ask Fevzi?
I'd like to ask him about his opinion of encryption on the internet, particularly whether PGP is compromised now.
Okay, can I just stop you there for 1 second? Because there will be a lot of people who don't know what PGP is. Fevzi, could you explain?
PGP is a software tool that stands for Pretty Good Privacy. so I kind of understand.
Nice name.
And it's an encryption tool. That's to say, it scrambles data for you, either for you to store or for you to send to another party for communication, secure communication. And increasingly now we have tools like WhatsApp and so forth, where they advertise them as being end-to-end encrypted. That's to say, a message as it leaves my device is scrambled and is only unscrambled at the other end, such that if someone else intercepts that message, they can have the message, but it's gobbledygook. And that's why people like Amber Rudd are up in arms when they say there should be no safe place for, you know, terrorists on the internet. They get upset because they can't easily hack those messages, although there are ways around it.
There we go. How does that work for you there, Pete?
Yeah, well, that's a good, reasonable description of PGP. The possibility, if you started to use a good encryption, well, that's a pretty good encryption method. But I think that it's probably compromised now. They've had to release the machineware and such that if you've got it installed on your machine, it can get they could work out how you're de-encrypting. But you could also carry a signature, and so the carriers of information could always know the origin if they insisted on you signing it, and you can sign it using the reverse method of encryption. And so the carriers of the information on the internet, if they insisted that it was signed, they could reduce the probability of them themselves being regarded as being a dissemination or disseminator of the information on there. They would simply be a carrier. They could then insist that they were simply a carrier, that the source was to be found guilty if they were carrying information which was libelous or whatever.
So forgive me if I can just interject. So there's two things that you've said there. This is an interesting topic, and it's quite a complex one, but I'll just try and break it down. So there's two things. One is, how secure are encryption tools such as PGP, and there are others as well? The answer is, we don't know for sure, because any encryption tool can have a backdoor written into it, and you wouldn't necessarily know unless the underlying code was made public. And then, even if there is no backdoor in the encryption tool, if something is doing, let's say, end-to-end encryption, as I say, with, say WhatsApp as an example, and there are others, so the message is encrypted as it leaves my phone, and it's decrypted as it arrives at yours. That sounds great. But if you are the subject of interest of one of the security services, for example, specifically you, then the first thing that they will do is they'll compromise your phone. They'll hack your phone and put a piece of infecting software on it. And what that software will do is pick up all your messages before they get to the encryption stage, before they leave your phone. They will copy the whole contents of your phone out to the NSA or GCHQ or whoever it is, and also they will make sure that any message is copied out before it's encrypted. So there's never anything that's 100%, but it kind of improves your odds. Having said that, there's one other factor to consider, and it's less true now, but it's still true to an extent. The security services sometimes become interested in people because they use encryption. They see that as an incriminating factor.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important that things like, you know, WhatsApp and other services switch on these technologies by default. So no one has to say, I want it. It's automatically there. And therefore, you're not a source of suspicion just because you want your privacy, which, by the way, you know, privacy is the basic foundation of a democracy. If you cannot have communication between citizens without the reasonable expectation of privacy, you cannot have a functioning democracy. But
the internet is basically non-encrypted at the moment.
Well, large parts of it are. I mean, you've got parts of it that are, you know, via things like HTTPS and so forth. So when you communicate with your bank, for example, you have an expectation that the communication of data between you and your bank's website is secure.
You have an expectation, but that's not necessarily true.
No, that's true. Look, the bottom line is this, and it's probably, you know, best not to go too far into this, because it's a very big and broad and deep topic. But the truth of it is this, and the rule of thumb is this: if you don't want it to be known, don't communicate it or store it electronically or on the internet.
There we go. Thank you so much for your call there, Pete in Leeds. I hope Fevzi gave you some answers there to what is a particularly difficult subject, and one we're going to touch on a little bit more after the news, really, because it is a difficult area, isn't it, Febzi?
It is. I mean, the technology of it is difficult. And again, there's this balance between, you know, how we protect our society from things like terrorism whilst maintaining our basic freedoms.